I call the meeting of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. Members, please take your seats. There is a quorum present. And may I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 29th, 2019?
So moved.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Hopefully I'm saying that correctly. Moves approval of the minutes for January 29th, 2019. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes for January 29th, 2019 are approved. Okay, we have another very informative day today that I'm really looking forward to. We are going to be starting out with the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs presentation of their organization and current challenges facing students. The council's mission is to advise and inform the governor and legislators on matters of importance to Latinos in Minnesota. The MCLA also conducts research and relays information within various policy areas impacting Minnesota Latinos. With us, we have Violeta. Did I say that correctly so far? Violeta Hernandez, the Council on Latino Affairs Legislative Policy Liaison, Anthony Villagrana as V. Oh, is it? Okay, V, right? And then Stephanie Flores Ortega, is it?
Ortiz,
excuse me. That was on my other notes, not on this one. Okay. So welcome to the committee, and you may proceed, Ms. Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope I can. I think, is the PowerPoint up for you here? Do I have to put it in PowerPoint mode?
Yeah, but not in the full frame mode. There you go.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. For the record, again, my name is Violeta Hernandez Espinosa. It's a hard name to pronounce, yes. I am education liaison for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. I've served in this capacity for a little over 2 years, so I feel like I have some understanding a little bit now of what this process looks like. Have been working with this legislature over a biennium and going into this new one. Looking forward to working with some faces, folks who we've worked with in the past, and some new faces in the committee and in the higher ed committee. One of the things that I'd like to share with the committee that some folks may not know is that part of my professional past, I was an admission counselor. So I was assistant dean of admission for my alma mater, Gustavus, for 4 years. So I served also in the capacity of coordinator of multicultural recruitment. So this world of transition from high school to college and the college experience, not only do I know from personal experience, but also through that area of expertise that I've had and experience with the higher education system. Since then, I've continued to provide presentations to parents fully in Spanish on the college process and financial aid process, and also meet one-on-one with students free of charge, just because I'm particularly passionate about this subject. So I know there is a Gusty in the room also, so fellow Gusties, hello. And we'll go here. I see that is this automatically changing, or did I change this?
It should not be automatic, but I can't tell you what exactly happened.
Okay, right. So I don't know if I had changed the presentation. So for you, I have prepared an overview of MCLA. I know you've heard from our partner councils, and won't go maybe too much into detail, highlight some aspects. I'm going to go and do a brief overview of Latino youth and enrollment. Here in the state, I'm going to touch on some of the barriers and community-identified solutions to higher education based on our extensive community stakeholder engagement. And we have some sharing of experiences by current college students and who identify as Latino or Latinx for the more inclusive term. Usually, as Representative Chair Bernardi pointed out, in the end we run out of time and I tend to over-talk and have a lot to present, and I have a lot of data to share with you. So I'm going to flip, and I'm going to have them share their experience first, And then you won't feel bad cutting me off when I need to cut off. You have the handouts and the information, so you have access to us at any point as well. So I will have Anthony Villagrana, another difficult name to say, but great name, and we'll have you share your experience with us first, Madam Chair.
And proceed, Mr. Villagrana.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair, and all members. My name is Anthony Villagrana. I am a second-year student at Augsburg University. I major in secondary education and literature. I'd say I adjusted pretty well to college. It's my second year. I would like to dedicate that success and well accommodation to a summer bridge program at Augsburg before my first year of college. It was a program where I stayed in the dorms for 5 to 6 weeks, and I got 2 college courses there, and that eased my transition into college itself. I chose Augsburg for its location. It's close to home. I am from Brooklyn Park. I've lived there my whole life. I chose Augsburg not only for its location, but for the financial aid that they offered me. As a Latinx student, I am proud to be at an institution that values diversity and the inclusion of all of its students. I feel confident and comfortable where I am, thankfully, and that's something not a lot of students can say sometimes. I have had nothing but positive experiences at Augsburg. I mean, a couple of negative experiences here and there, but I'm glad to be where I am today. In high school, I struggled with applications to college. I didn't know what exactly to write in my applications. There's long, tell us about you, tell us about your ambitions, your goals. And in high school, you don't really know what you want to do sometimes. I sure didn't. So it's really hard for me sometimes to fill out those applications, especially with FAFSA. So as a first-generation student, I couldn't really go to my parents for help. They didn't know really about the college process, what college was. They can only say, keep trying, do your best, and you got it. But in terms of technical help, I didn't have any of that, just emotional and mental support. One of the biggest challenges now that I am in college is money, however. There are expenses left and right sometimes, finding out how am I going to eat, paying for tuition. I hate asking my parents, hey, the tuition bill is coming up, but it's something I have to do due to I don't have the money myself for it. Luckily, I have scholarships such as the Minnesota State Grant that helped me pay for college, and this financial aid that I receive is a major part of my experience. I recently moved off campus, however, to save money, but unfortunately, due to like housing contracts, I am still paying as if I lived there, but I'm not getting the housing and the meal plan that I should get since I'm paying for it, unfortunately. However, besides this instance, I have gotten lots of help from other departments, the Career Center, the Wellness Center, TRIO, and College Possible have always supported me. I've always had help and counselors, advisors, teachers and professors, both in high school and now in college especially, that always help me with questions such as financial aid questions, career planning, and scheduling courses, etc. I like to think of myself as a self-disciplined, determined young man. I like to bring a lot of energy and motivation to all my classmates. I want to be a teacher when I graduate, so I strive to include everyone and keep the high pace and the learning environment. I am proud to say that my mindset and strong work ethic has put me in the position that I am today, whether it is as a young educator, a tutor, and a student, more importantly. I'm excited about the future because I know there are many opportunities outside of college. I know that the harder I work, the more doors will open up for me, and that motivates me to put my best foot forward and be the best student and overall person that I can be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And would you, Ms. Flores Ortiz?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Stephanie Flores Ortiz. I am a junior at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and currently majoring in sociology with a potential minor in business. I was invited here today to speak about my journey through higher education and how I transitioned from high school to college. The first challenge that I faced as a first-generation college student was how to apply for scholarships and college applications and where to find them. Because I am a student who had parents that did not possess the knowledge about the application process and the finances to go to a four-year institution, I was never able to ask them the questions that I had, and therefore they could only encourage and support from a distance. I had no idea where to begin. It wasn't until I got into the program Youth in Action that is part of CLUES. Youth in Action is a program for Latino students that helps with the college process and also provides a mentor to be beside you every step of the way and help guide you when you are lost. With my mentor and this program to support me, I was able to get more information about the process and begin my steps to go into college. I was in Youth in Action for 2 years, and I continue to be part of the CLUES community because I see that they help so many people here in the Twin Cities and individual families. After a long time trying to decide what was best, I decided to go to community college because at the time, that was the most financially reasonable for me and my parents. After a year at Century College, I decided to embark on the journey of living on campus at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. This is where I had the most trouble. I found it very difficult in finding information about how to transfer credits, what credits were accepted at the University of Wisconsin that I was interested in. It seemed that it was made difficult to find this information, and after doing much search and speaking to counselors, I was able to be pointed in a vague direction. I figured out how to transfer my credits on my own, and in the end found that it was ultimately up to the university to decide if the courses I had taken would be accepted, which was frustrating. I had spent the time taking these courses, trying to get the best grade that I possibly could to only find out in the end that they weren't acceptable because it didn't meet a certain criterion. Once I transferred, I was 3 hours away from home in a place where I knew no one. I was alone and afraid. I had gotten used to my Latino community, and that is what I was missing most. It ultimately was a cause for me to leave that university and attend the University of Minnesota. Community is something that is important to me and many that I know, as it is a way for me to be comfortable around those who share the same journey as me and the same culture. What I miss most about the Latino community was having people who were part of my culture, who understood a lot of the things that I also enjoyed, and the camaraderie that came with being a part of that community. The lack of community and institutions where you are far away from family can take a toll on mental health and ultimately cause students to leave the university and head back home. I wanted to go to college and also finish because I want to help my parents when it comes to their retirement and even before then. I want to be able to help my parents with their expenses. They did so much for me by coming to a brand new place where they knew almost no one and had to start all over again. This is why I continue to work and put myself through school for them, as they are my inspiration to keep going.
Thank you very much. So, Ms. Hernandez, we have until 3 to 3:05 today to get through the testimony and questions from members.
Madam Chair, thank you. I will try to cover as much as possible, but again, you have direct access to us at any point. I'm going into overview of MCLA. Again, you've heard from our other councils, and Madam Chair has explained a little bit of our mandate here, how we exist legislatively. One of the first things that I want to point out for the members is that the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs is in its 40th anniversary this year. Believe it or not, the state is a leader in ensuring that we have a council such as this to represent the voices of those most underserved in communities. So we are celebrating this in 40th anniversary. You'll be hopefully getting invites for different events along the way. And we began our journey as the Spanish-Speaking Affairs Council in 1978. Few name changes later and restructurings later, and in 2015 we became the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. So up until this last fall, we waited for a couple years to get our emails changed from CLAC or Chicano Latino Affairs Council to MCLA, but we're finally there. So you finally see that on our emails. Second, I would like to point out the constituency we represent. I think that there's questions. Identity is a big conversation within the Latino community and with other ethnic minority communities. We represent a very diverse community. We talk about a homogeneous Latino community. We're actually representing many Latino communities in the state of Minnesota that have heritages in over 20 Latin American countries. So while we often talk about Spanish-speaking, we have indigenous languages in our communities. We have folks from very different histories and contexts, so it's really important to have that pointed out. One of the other things that makes us unique is our structure. Each ethnic council, by their executive director and council, decides how they structure their staff. And we have a grand team of four team members. And each one of us is responsible for a focus area that was set by our council. And so we have four focus areas, which are immigration, education, health, and economic development. And so a lot of what we do is encompassed that way. So this is why you do not see the executive director. I am your direct contact for education affairs. In your folders, you have an overview of NCLA. And looks like this. It's a small little handout. Inside, you also have our legislative priorities by focus area. I know that you are focused on education, but you touch other committees as well. This is our legislative priorities, and I'll share how we've arrived on those legislative priorities later. This is it. Also in your folders, you have this handout. And some of you may have already noticed this one-page handout is specific to your district, and it has four key indicators in our focus areas for each one of your districts. It talks about the population of Latino communities in your district. I'm going to use Representative Vang's district, if I may, has 3,900 Latino community members. And this is 10% of the district's total population and one of the largest Latino populations in the state. So it breaks it down for you in case you're curious to know about your particular district. This is just an example of the type of service we can provide for you if you want us to do more research, have you come to listening sessions with you, plan listening sessions with you. That's the type of work we can do with you as well. So getting into an overview here of the Latino community and Latino youth specifically, which we could say the Latino community is youth. The Latino community is a very young community. The median age for Latino communities, community members, today we are about 285,000 Latinos in the state of Minnesota, and 24 is our median age. Anthony held.
21.
Leadership right in the room, right? We have about 39% of the state's Latino community is children under the age of 18. And again, when folks look at leadership, this is the current leadership, right? In our community, we have very young leaders. 92% of all Minnesotan Latino children, so that 40% are native-born, many of them, the majority of them in Minnesota. And Latinos are the fastest-growing demographic in the state, which makes it imperative, right, to address the not only the early education, but the higher education of this community as we're trying to move together as a state, right? We don't speak of a dichotomy. Latinos are Minnesotans, and that's really important to point out here. As far as enrollment, you see here on the top the K-12 enrollment. At the bottom, you see the higher ed enrollment for Latino students. We have about 82,000 K-12 students. And we have Latino students and about 14,000 higher education Latino students make up 9.3% of the K-12 enrollment and 5.6% of the higher education enrollment. You can, just in those statistics, you can see why is it that a larger percentage of our community is not continuing on to the higher education atmosphere. Where are these students attending once they go into the higher education system? State colleges, which is community colleges and technical colleges, house 51% of Latino higher education enrollment. You'll see that the majority of Latino students are in public institutions and disproportionately in community colleges, which I'll talk wrap up a little bit. We know that these particular colleges have low graduation rates and low transfer rates in the state, extremely low if I would qualify that, again, as a former admission counselor. That is a concerning note to take note of. And so in this particular slide, I have five key indicators for Latino students. Again, I'm covering E12 in this particular aspect because they have to go through that before we can even get them to the purview of your committee, correct? And so today, 38% of Latino third graders are achieving reading and language arts. 35% Latino, let me compare that, I have a comparison here. So that compares to 59.4% for all Minnesota third graders. Math standards, 35.4% for Latino eighth graders, and that compares with 57.8% for all Minnesota eighth graders. In our graduation rate, 73.5%, that compares to 85.6% for all Minnesota students. ELL students are at 72.9%. In 2012, which is not too long ago, the four-year graduation rate was 54.3%. So a few years back, you had a 50-50 chance of actually graduating on time and graduating from high school, which is a bright spot for the state. That's something that should be highlighted. However, when you combine that with our reading scores and our math scores, it's a point to reflect on, right? Are we really preparing youth for that next step and to prepare them for success? Well, we know that the tests are not the only indicator of success for students. They're still indicators, right? They're still one of the indicators. So for your purview, 24% of the Latinos 25 to 44 have a post-secondary certificate or degree, and only 19.8% have an associate's degree or higher for those between the age of 25 and 44. It's important to point out here that there's disparities within the Latino community as far as attainment, and that's important to point out in the importance of data disaggregation. Those Latino folks of Puerto Rican heritage, 53%. Have an associate's degree or higher. And of Mexican heritage, 15% have an associate's degree or higher. Other Latino subgroups are at 28% have an associate's degree or higher. So, again, highlights the importance of talking about not a homogeneous Latino community, but a community that has a diversity of needs, and it's important to figure out what those needs are so that we can best address them, correct? You'll notice that I have an arrow on a particular indicator. I'm pretty sure many of you know why I have this indicator, but I'm not going to test you. But that's Minnesota's higher education attainment goal. Minnesota has an attainment goal for higher education, and this was set in the 2015 legislature, signed into law, that all Minnesotans will have a post-secondary certificate or degree at 70%. By 2025. As you can see, our state goal is at 70%. For Latino communities, we're at 24%. We have a lot of work to do, and again, we're here to support you as you try to identify strategies to best address the needs of these particular communities. And one of the ways we do that is through extensive community engagement, which is really a cornerstone of our council since its last executive director came on board and our team came together. A lot of our team came at the same time because there was a lot of changes in the council in 2015-2016 year. And this is a priority for all of us. We want to make sure that we're actually having direct contact with the various stakeholders and communities that are going to be impacted by the policy decisions we make here at the state. So over the last 2 years, we've had 17 listening sessions in 15 cities and towns. You'll see a list there, including Greater Minnesota, mostly Greater Minnesota, and some here in the metro. Again, it's a little bit equitable vision, right? It's a little bit easier for Stephanie and Anthony to come and share their experiences with you. I was born and raised in southern Minnesota. Not born. So take that back. I was raised in southern Minnesota, so a two-hour drive to the capital is also something to consider, right? So we had 350 community stakeholders participate. This is families, this is Latino community. And we also conducted one-to-one meetings with superintendents, principals, mayors, police chiefs, teachers, priests. We really did a deep dive at the needs and challenges of the community. So in your folder, of course, you have a copy of this report. And it's also available online on our website, and I'd be happy to share any more information about it. Again, there's a lot of good findings. There's an education section for you that you can look at more closely. That way we don't have to we can continue the conversation on this particular report. We have a 2018 supplementary report that also will be coming out soon, so we'll share that on our website as well and with you. So in this particular slide is a nice summary of what we found in our listening sessions. Okay, this addresses K-12 and higher education barriers for Latino communities. And you'll notice there the big themes, support from educators and support staff, support from parents, access to higher education, of course, was a big conversation, and of course, the opportunity gap, again, which are factors that students cannot themselves control and is a big impact for our communities. So I'm going to do, again, a little bit overview of the higher ed barriers and invite you for further conversation on the other findings. And some of you are on E12, so I will talk briefly about that as well in committee in the future. As far as the higher education barriers and challenges that were more salient for our community, we're looking at a lack of system knowledge by both students and parents. Our testifiers spoke to that today. A lack of individualized assistance, and that goes beyond our traditional ways of looking at go to your high school counselor, go to because of the higher need of students, to parents may not necessarily have that system understanding, even if they speak the language, right? And we have that huge language barrier for a lot of our Latino community that hasn't been addressed and continues to keep parents outside of involvement in both E12 and higher education. We have limited local knowledge and supportive programming and financial aid specific to Latino students. And this is particularly important for things like knowing that we have things such as the Minnesota Dream Act, that we have particular that the Office of Higher Education does presentations if you're requested. But again, having that knowledge out to the community is a big barrier as well. The economic barrier continues to be by far the major barrier to the community. Again, our community is many immigrant community. We have an established Latino community, but also many new folks to the state. In the early 1990s, when my family immigrated to southern Minnesota, we had about 50,000 Latino community members in the state. Now we have 285,000. So again, we still need to be supporting new Minnesotans. As far as higher education priorities for our communities, you'll look. And again, these come from our listening sessions and from stakeholder engagement for folks who are directly serving Latino communities. Increased financial aid for students, targeted is best. Again, it's a very different experience and different barriers for Latino students. Increasing money for programs. Both Anthony and Stephanie talked about particular programs that help them, guide them through that process. I did not know this until now, that I was also a youth in action mentor for 3 years, over the last 3 years. So that's how we initially met. And again, those particular programs are so important in the mentoring process. I did grow up without a mentoring program in southern Minnesota. Again, looking at things like college in the schools, because those don't have a cost, it's in the school, there's not a transportation barrier. Career tech ed, grow your own teaching programs, things that are in the school. The Torch program in Northfield, many of you may know that is one of the leading programs to get Latino students to succeed in the E-12 system, and they've been highlighted a lot. And your committees have supported their work in the past. So they wanted to make sure that we talk to you about that. And, again, schools and educators need to be culturally responsive because of language, because of the different barriers that Latino youth experience. Increasing adult basic education, and that goes for all communities. Even the communities that are serving Latino communities want to learn Spanish. We don't have intensive programs to learn Spanish. Increased support in the language to navigate the complex education system. Everything we do at MCLA, our aim is to translate it. But that takes time, that takes money, that takes extra resources, right? And our community colleges, again, I would like to point out, should more closely reflect the diversity of our communities, and we have to address the low graduation and transfer rates of these colleges that are serving the majority of Latino students. We haven't taken a deep look at that. I will close with our main priority in education. Out of all of these things that our community wants, we will be coming to you in the next few days, hopefully introducing a bill shortly here this week, next week. The Increased Teachers of Color Act of 2019, our ethnic partner councils have talked about that. That has been our number one priority in education over the last two years and over the biennium, and it continues to be the priority. It's comprehensive. It addresses E-12, addresses higher ed, addresses many of the needs of the Latino community that you've heard, and it is the number one priority in education for Latino communities. We have 629 Latino educators out of the 60,000 educators in this state. And while we're not saying that other folks cannot teach Latino students, it's about removing barriers. And we think that this is a route, right? Teachers are the number one factor in student success. So we'll talk to you more about this, and we look forward to having your support on this particular bill. Anthony, thank you for taking on that challenge. Looks forward to being a teacher. So when I heard that he was interested in this, I was excited to also have him testify today. So with that, that's what we have for you. And again, thank you, Anthony Villagrana and Stephanie Flores Ortiz, Violeta Hernandez Espinosa from the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. You have our contact information. You have a lot of information in your hands. Do let us know if you need help understanding whatever is in there. I have 10 additional pages of raw research on higher education and economic that couldn't be fit into 4 pages for this report. So if you really want to know more, I have more to share with you.
Madam Chair. Thank you. That was a very comprehensive overview. We appreciate that. We have 2 questions, and yes, we'll get through those quickly here. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had one quick one for both of the students, to Anthony and to Stephanie. Do both of you anticipate finishing in 4 years? Will you be done? You've got 1 more year, you said, Stephanie?
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 for, okay. Is that the track you're going to be on? Is that, I hear a lot of students that have trouble doing that, and it adds to the cost and everything else. So just curious if you've got that figured out, so.
Well, I'm currently a part-time student, and I work full-time to be able to continue in school. So for me, realistically, I won't be finishing next year. It's probably going to take me another semester or 2 afterwards to be able to finish with my 4-year degree.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Flores. And Mr. Villagrana? Grana, sorry, excuse me. Would you like to respond?
So, yeah, like you said, I have 2 more years of my education. I'm the opposite of you. I do part-time. I work 2 jobs on campus, and I'm a full-time student. So it's just all about saving the money up for those. These are like 4 more semesters of my college career and finishing getting that teaching degree.
4 years?
Yeah, 2 more years.
Total 4 years?
Yeah.
4 and 5.
Good.
Wow.
Good,
very hard workers. Thank you. And Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned earlier about communities rather than a single Latino community, and that there seems to be groups within that perhaps have more disparities, more challenges than others. And kind of, can you talk a little bit about what might be underlying that and identify the differences between the communities, and especially if there's something that we should think about in the higher ed committee.
And Ms. Hernandez, we are going over a little bit for this testimony, so we're going to try to have you respond in 2 minutes to that question.
And I look forward to a further conversation about that. Again, we have ethnic origin or geographic origin in over 20 Latin American countries. It's a vast continent with different histories, different complex. Many of us have different reasons for emigrating or coming to Minnesota. And, again, you're looking at the experience of the Central American countries and the violence and different aspects that have impacted the continent over a period of time. We have, particularly when we look at the Puerto Rican community, again, it's a very different status, legal status within the United States than maybe for Mexican communities that may have struggled, have more multi-status families, immigration status. And one of the big things that Minnesota has done really well is in supporting our Minnesota Dream Act, which has probably had an impact on our graduation rate from high school. To be honest with you, it's a look and saying we support your future here in Minnesota for all these young folks that have come and are here in Minnesota now. That is a deep dive that we have to do. Why is it that, but it allows us to ask that question, right, for all of us to be looking at what is driving those different factors, right? The majority of the Latino community in Minnesota is of Mexican descent. So again, where does that fit into the picture? But very diverse community.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez. Yes,
sorry.
Again, thank you for your presentation. And now we are going to move on to our next presentation by Lead Minnesota. And as we exchange spots here, I want to let you know that Lead Minnesota represents 180,000 two-year college students in Minnesota state system to help them advocate for themselves and their communities. With us, we have President of Lead Minnesota, Frankie Bexara, and with Leeds Minnesota Treasurer, Dylan Forcier. Welcome to the community, Frankie and Dylan, and may you proceed with your presentation. And I did not introduce the other person, so you'll have to introduce yourself when that time comes. And I understand that you came from, at least one person came from quite a distance. So, and what we'd like to do is we would like to wrap up this presentation by 25 minutes to 4, if at all possible, and that's with our members' questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the House Higher Education Committee. My name is Frankie Becerra. I am a student at Century College, a proud Fridley Tiger alum, and president of LEAD MN, the statewide student association of community and technical college students in the great state of Minnesota. I've been asked to testify today about what LEAD MN is and how we advocate on behalf of students. LEAD MN represents over 180,000 two-year college students that come from all four corners of Minnesota to advocate for opening doors to opportunity for every person in this state. We believe that everyone should have the opportunity to achieve their dreams. At LEAD MN, every student has the potential to be a leader that will help address tomorrow's challenges. We are one of the oldest and largest dues-paying student associations focused exclusively on community and technical college students. There are four main pillars that define our work. The first pillar is leadership success or skills. We offer workshops and trainings at our conferences that teach leadership and interpersonal skills to students. Our second pillar is empowering leaders. We provide real-world experience to students through serving on the LEAD MN board and committees. The first two pillars work together to teach students important leadership lessons that they need to take charge of their own lives and lead others in engaging ways. The third pillar is achieving success. We provide mentors, resources, and scholarships to students to help them remove the barriers of their success. LEAD-MN has awarded over $185,000 in scholarships to students. Our fourth pillar to our program is driving change. We inspire and prepare students to tackle issues on the campus level and at the community level that directly affect them. Over the past several years, we advocated for making college more affordable, closing the opportunity gap, and improving student success on campus by reforming the developmental education process and the transfer process. LEAD-MN is the voice of students by engaging leaders at all 48 community and technical college campuses in Minnesota. Through our General Assembly, students decide what issues are important to their students on their campus by incorporating it in our platform document and in the legislative agenda. This democratic process ensures that we represent the voice of students across the state. Over the last several months, I've spoken with hundreds of students about their experiences at a community and technical college level, and that database continues to grow. Each student story is grounded in the idea that earning a college degree is supposed to be the surest step in achieving the American dream. But to many students, they're realizing that the high cost of college has pushed the American dream even further from their reach. Instead of achieving their dream, their journey has become a nightmare for too many Minnesotans. These individuals have taken out over $27 billion in student debt to pay for their education after high school. My personal story is very similar. By all accounts, I was never supposed to be in college, certainly not here. Both of my parents didn't get their GEDs until later in life, and I am a DACA recipient. Home for me has always been Minnesota, though. So there I was, working to achieve my own version of the American dream, 18 years old, attending a state university. My American dream was not just my own, but a dream of my entire family. The dream of going to college to get my whole family ahead. I quickly realized that the perceptions of college were not going to be my reality. I thought that all my expenses were going to be covered by FAFSA and scholarships. It's not the reality. So I went to get a job to help pay for school, but working 40 hours a week didn't cover the bills either. Every day, I had to make a decision. Do I study? Do I work? Can I eat or go to class hungry? Some nights, I would leave work and grab a meal replacement shake, thinking that it would be a healthy option. It ended up not being a snack or a healthy option, but a lifeline. Some nights when I would miss my bus or just simply couldn't afford the bus back to campus, I had to walk 3.4 miles back to campus. On those nights, I thought it was kind of funny that the only thing lower than the temperature was my bank account at the time. I could only imagine that type of walk on a day like today. On those walks, I knew that whatever physical hunger I had would eventually leave me. But the mental and emotional hunger, that'll never leave me. For I was not only hungry for change, I was starving. Right now, 2 in 5 students face food insecurity issues like I have. Thus, a student's hardest test should come within the classroom. But students today aren't solely being graded by quizzes and papers and tests. They're being graded on how well they can handle hunger, homelessness, and figuring out how to pay for school that is simply not affordable. At this time, I would like to pass the microphone to Dylan Forcier.
Thanks, Frankie. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Dylan Forcier. I am the LEAD-MN treasurer and a student at Lake Superior College online. I'm studying business finance. However, currently I live in Hutchinson, and if you do the math, it's a little far from Lake Superior College. So I was offered a job to help run a hotel, and I took it. And that has proven very beneficial for me as I try to pay my way through school, save up for university, and pay for my expenses. The reason I decided to finish up my associate's degree at Lake Superior College is that there was no guarantee that Ridgewater College in Hutchinson which is less than 5 minutes away from my apartment, would actually transfer the credits to Lake Superior College. I was hoping to take some of my more advanced math classes in person with a professor face-to-face. However, because I was very worried that I would have to eventually just retake them, I am stuck taking them online. And for anyone that has ever taken an advanced math course online, it's not an easy feat. I really wish that Minnesota State would step up to the plate and put more pathways in place to make this easier for students, like and unlike myself. So for many students, this process of transferring is complicated and messy. The process of losing credits, having to retake medial education courses, and ultimately have their graduation date stalled. All the while, they're racking up student loan debt, and they're expending much-needed grants and scholarships. In fact, 22% of the students who enroll in our colleges transfer. And in a 1996 Board of Trustees document that states, "What Minnesotans want most from the merger of institutions that formed MinSCU was greater ease for students to transfer between and among colleges and universities." It has been almost 25 years now, and transfer issues still exist. At the direction of the legislature, Minnesota State has been working to create some transfer pathways, but there is still more work to be done. There are opportunities to expand some of the current pathways that are being implemented, some opportunities to improve transfer from community college to community college that would benefit a student like myself, and expand access for those students who wish to transfer to the University of Minnesota. Because regardless of what school a student decides on, where they want to go, they should not be delayed, discouraged, or hindered because of that choice or because of the minor differences in course descriptions. Another area that LEAD-MN is focused on this year is Open Educational Resources, or OER for short. Open Educational Resources are a free open source textbook that anyone can use or edit. This allows students to have their textbooks readily available on the first day of class, and instructors can actually customize these materials to fit their course curriculum. For almost 7 years now, LEAD-MN has worked to promote OER at Minnesota State and the legislature. Last session, LEAD-MN worked on some legislation that would have required Minnesota State to develop a system-wide plan to increase the use of OER. I'd like to give a special thanks to Representative Daniels for his help on OER last session. And while our legislation was ultimately vetoed as the part, the final Omnibus Prime bill, our work to address textbook affordability continues. You see, without the extra burden of these costs, students will be able to focus more on getting in and getting out and then contributing positively to our economy. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce a student at Anoka Ramsey Community College. They are the Regional Vice President of Phi Theta Kappa and Student Senate Vice President at Anoka Ramsey Community College, Cambridge. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Julia Yates. I'm a 19-year-old student from Anoka Ramsey Community College in Cambridge, Minnesota. I am studying communications and psychology. Throughout my academic journey, I have faced many hardships that could have been avoided if state policy reflected the needs of current students. During my time as a community college student, I've had to cut many corners in order to afford an opportunity to pursue my passions and catalyst me into my future. Because of the high cost of tuition, I have been faced with the reality of being unable to afford gas money to get to campus. I have been frugal. To some, that means not going to Starbucks every day or not eating out. For me, frugal was couch surfing from friend's couch to friend's couch so that I could pay, because I couldn't pay rent. Therefore, then I could pay my tuition. I sacrificed so much for school. It is the determination of so many college students to not be stopped by the unrealistic obstacles to get the education they need. Students understand that this is an investment into themselves that will enable them to have a better future. But it goes beyond just being frugal for many students. For me, it meant that I was unable to afford basic car maintenance, such as replacement of tires, brakes, and the random emergency fixes required when owning a vehicle. On a day like today, that can be deadly. When the suspension went out in my bravada at the beginning of fall semester, I was unable to pay for the textbooks required for one of my psychology courses. It was due to the cost of tuition, textbooks, and unexpected emergencies that I also had to sacrifice being able to purchase groceries for 2 weeks. It wasn't until a month into the course that I was able to purchase the required materials for that course, after the first test was already taken. These costs place a huge burden on students that has an impact on their academic success. While there is cost in solving these problems, we have to remember that there is also a cost for inaction. The state of Minnesota spent $110.6 million on first-year dropouts, according to estimates by the American Institute of Research. They also found that Minnesota lost over $188 million in potential tax revenue from the 2002 cohort of first-year freshmen pursuing a bachelor's degree. Imagine the benefits to the state of Minnesota if we had invested in those students and helped them graduate. That's a win-win for everyone. Thank you for your time. I'm going to pass it back to Frankie.
Your testimony. And Mr. Becerra.
For our students, Julia, Dylan, Stephanie, former student, myself, these types of experiences with affordability and food insecurity are not abnormal. Our students face major barriers to obtaining a college degree that were not common 20 years ago. But today, they are the norm that requires policy change to help address them. If we don't do more to ensure that the students get the education they need after high school, the Minnesota workforce is not going to be prepared for the jobs of the next decade. Madam Chair, committee members, I ask that you help us in giving every Minnesota student the opportunity to reach their own version of the American dream. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Very impressive. Do we have any questions from our members? Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. President Becerra, I just wanted to ask for if you have any specific ideas on that food security issue. I know myself, I'm a big eater, and I never like to serve constituents on an empty stomach. But, you know, I can't, you know, we want to have our students being pushed with their minds, with their ideas, with their research, not being pushed to get through the day on an empty stomach. So I just want to know if, and I see there's a material that I didn't get, but just if you could give us some more ideas on what we could do to make sure that every student is learning on a healthy stomach.
Yeah, so I think
Mr. Becerra.
So I think part of the ideas that we've had has been the expansion of food shelves or food pantries on our campuses and seeing an expansion of resources. The Office of Higher Education does have an EAPS grant, so that would help for emergency situations and seeing expansion of that. So I think there are some solutions in place, but just the expansion of those overall would go a long way.
Thank you, Mr. Becerra, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I really appreciate you being here today, and I give a shout out for Fridley, which I represent, and as well as Noka Ramsey, one of my former colleges. So thank you all for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, for our next testifiers, we are going to move to the University of Minnesota's the impact of the federal shutdown. With us, we have Vice President of Research Chris Kramer, Mike Volna, Associate Vice President of Finance and Assistant CFO, and Nate Peterson, the Associate Director of One Stop Student Services. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony in the order that you prefer, and say your name and your affiliate, your job.
Madam Chair and distinguished members, thank you for that introduction. My name is Chris Kramer. I'm the Vice President for Research at the University of Minnesota, and I'm also a professor of chemistry. The federal shutdown had, partial federal shutdown, had a number of effects on the university, from things that were very much resembled what was happening at the national level. So we did have a few researchers who were directly paid by some of the shutdown agencies. That meant they were not receiving their paychecks, and we scrambled a bit to see what options we might have in order to bridge them during that time period. And the research mission of the university itself, which is vast and affects all of Minnesota and has global impact, was also affected in a number of ways, partly because we have federal partners who were unable to engage with us. That includes, for instance, the Department of Agriculture, which has buildings on our St. Paul campus, which were closed, and the research going on in those facilities was stopped. And then in addition, research projects underway where agencies were unable to make decisions that were important for that research to go forward. Now, on the one hand, that the shutdown lasted a bit over 30 days, and one might think, well, that's not all that long. But when a shutdown is in place, if there are certain things that can't happen, there's some research that's seasonal. You need to take samples during a certain part of the year. If you miss that part of the year, then you have a one-year delay before you can do it again. We heard from researchers who are working on invasive terrestrial plants, for instance, for whom that was an issue, oak wilt, which affects all of Minnesota, as well as people looking at turnover in lakes, seasonal turnover of the water in lakes, which affects fisheries and aquatic species in general. So those are important components. And I think I would also mention that there's substantial disruption when people hear about research dollars. There's a tendency to think there's a pit somewhere one is pouring money into, and that pit is labeled research. But actually, it's mostly going to people. It's the researchers themselves. And the vast majority of those researchers are young people in training, graduate students, postdocs, undergraduate students. For them, the uncertainty of not knowing whether the project they're working on is going to continue, is the university going to float the money during the course of that time period, is a source of considerable concern. And you've heard from very articulate students earlier this afternoon about how important those paychecks can be for them to make ends meet. The shutdown is over, apparently, although I guess we'll all see what happens in a couple of weeks. But it's really not over. The agencies themselves have an enormous backlog. NSF pointed out they've got 2,000 unreviewed project proposals that came in during the course of the shutdown. They've got to get to those, and of course there were things already scheduled that are, will they displace them, will they handle them? I personally am a co-investigator in a National Science Foundation Center for Sustainable Polymers at the University of Minnesota. It's a $20 million center. It's up for renewal this spring. Those are dollars that pay researchers, pay tax dollars to the state of Minnesota. We're very hopeful there's not a delay in a potential renewal. So I think I'll just finish by mentioning the scale. Last year, roughly $200 million was awarded to the university by agencies that were closed as part of the federal shutdown. So it's by no means a small problem. And then I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mike Volna, who is the expert on the financial side.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Volna.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, members of the committee. My name is Mike Volna. I'm the Associate Vice President for Finance and Assistant CFO for the university. As Vice President Kramer said or implied, when the shutdown occurred, the university adopted an approach whereby we felt that since most of this activity with the federal government was under grant or contract arrangements, that the federal government would repay all of its the expenditures we incurred, and in fact in the past they've done that, so we wanted to try and hold researchers, grad students, whatever, as harmless as possible. So what that meant was we essentially continued to allow spending to occur on these grants and federal contracts with the expectation that we would incur those expenses, we would have unreimbursed expenses, and when the government shutdown ended that we would get reimbursed. That total through yesterday was about $10.1 million of unreimbursed expenses. We don't budget for that because, as I said, these are all under federal grants and contracts. We budget that those federal agencies will pay for it. And so if the federal government changed its practice and decided that they weren't going to reimburse us, that would be a huge problem. But we expect that we will be paid. And, in fact, they are beginning to already pay past invoices. We have to float a loan to the federal government. That's what it comes down to. You heard the figure, I think, from other people that we spent about $500,000 a day on unreimbursed expenses, and that's about where that number occurred. Our hope, as Vice President Kramer said, is that if on February 15th or whenever we end up with another shutdown, that those unreimbursed balances and expenses will have been paid to us so that we're not continuing to loan the federal government money on top of what we would then have to go into with the next shutdown. But that's just a brief summary of where we landed from a financial standpoint.
Thank you very much. And Peterson, proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. My name is Nate Peterson. I'm the Associate Director of One Stop Student Services at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. One Stop Student Services is home to student registration, student accounts and billing, financial aid, and university veteran benefits, in addition to a couple of other services. At an institution our size, having all of those in one spot really fits the needs of students and allows them to come to talk to us about multiple types of issues. As the home of financial aid for students, students are already stressed about finances when it comes to their college experiences. We've heard that before today throughout other testimonies. They should be able to focus on their academics and focus on their classes and studying, but instead we have started to hear stories from students who are stressed out over money and stressed out over the shutdown and the impact that it was going to have on them. Now, in reality, does the shutdown have an impact on a ton of our students? Probably not with regard to financial aid. And that's because we're in the middle of an academic year. So students have already filled out their financial aid paperwork. But that doesn't mean that students who may be starting their spring term with us at the University of Minnesota, or maybe who applied late with their FAFSA, or who were receiving veterans benefits, were not stressed out over the possibility that they would not get their money on time. Luckily, in general, the news and media made that kind of a scare tactic for students, in all honesty. So students were getting their veterans benefits, but we did hear from them, and they would say, hey, am I going to get my money? I need that money to pay my mortgage, to pay for food, to pay for my classes, lots of different things. We're lucky, though, that we did end up getting those veteran benefit money. A couple of other issues with regards to financial aid processing that we did see at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. Some students were unable to verify their income with the IRS, and we had to wait for a week or two for the Department of Education to give us, the National Department of Education, not the Minnesota, to give us guidance on how we could process that financial aid paperwork. And we are just kind of waiting to see if the shutdown occurs again and systems start to shut down again. Verifying students' selective service or citizenship, those become real issues for us when we're looking at financial aid. When we understood that the shutdown was going to happen, we did create internal processes to work with students who may be impacted by the shutdown. And that goes much further than students and their financial aid. We don't know how many of our students are impacted by parents who maybe were employed as one of the 800,000 federal workers who are furloughed and not paid, or were, people who may be waiting on money from those individuals, so such as daycare providers or things like that, who the trickle-down effects have not yet been felt at the university. We did devise some internal processes where we would work with students, but those students did have to self-identify and come to us because there's no way for us to know that they may be impacted by the shutdown. We did do a number of campaign materials encouraging students, if they were impacted by the shutdown, to contact our office directly, and that was system-wide, so all five campuses did that, reaching out to students and saying, if you are impacted, please come and talk to us, and we can help you. We can create individualized plans to make sure that this is not impacting your academic success at the university. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from our members? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Can Vice President Kramer, can you tell me a little bit more about the polymer thing that you brought up? I'm just curious.
We can go till how long?
Yeah, right, exactly. Go ahead, Mr. Kramer.
Chair Bernardi and Representative Lilly. Yes, I'd be happy to tell you. So the National Science Foundation has something called Center for Chemistry Innovation. Large centers, they're $20 million over 5 years. There's probably a dozen of them scattered around the nation. The university successfully competed for one. They're quite hard to get, as you might imagine, roughly 5 years ago, and one has an opportunity to renew once. So it's a pretty high-stakes site visit. You go to Washington, and you take a team, and you make your best shot to get that next $20 million. So that's scheduled for early March, or at least it was. We have no idea whether they'll continue to hold that date or move us to a different date. And the challenge, as I alluded to, is even if we're successful and we're renewed, and we will be renewed, but if it's delayed by a significant extent, you know, it's just not practical or humane to lay off the researchers for the months that might happen in the interim as that new award spins up after the old award ended. Instead, we'll do our best to find other ways that we might bridge that funding, but that's funding that could have gone to something else. So that's really the concern, is that it's not just an immediate return to business as usual. We've really lost a certain amount of time, and one has to recover.
Well, thank you very much for coming out on this cold day. I think you would have had the day off, I think, and you still came to our committee. So I don't know if that was good or bad, but we appreciate you prioritizing this and helping us to better understand how this has affected University of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do sympathize with that. I was doing research on a detector for the Super Collider when they pulled the funding, and we figured out that we could shift it into PET detector and other medical imaging. But I do understand what that can happen, especially when you have dissertation projects that become fluid. But my question is to the staff here, and I didn't bring it up during lead because I didn't know what time we'd have. They were talking about a bigger new demand, but in a cyclical nature, there have been food insecurity and other issues over the decades as the economy has cycled. I mean, I was fortunate the winter that I was living out of my car while being a student that it wasn't this cold, it was a mild one. But I understand what they're talking about. So I wasn't aware of at that time of any programs, but I think there probably were. So can staff look and see what current and past programs of, you know, covering some of the issues they were talking about? So we have some resources. I'm sure some that were funded and disappeared maybe, you know, some decades ago. Sort of understanding what the local community and campus programs might be, the statewide or state-funded programs, and has there ever been, or is anyone working on a website or a resource, because it's not just that you have the programs, do the people know? We have a very diverse student population, especially with the mix between, on campus, part-time, full-time working, etc., but we have remote learning and other things of where, how do we make it available and easy for the students to find if they need a resource? Because you can have everything out there for them. If they don't know, it doesn't do them any good. So I know it's sort of an open-ended type thing, but it'd be useful for staff, because as we start talking about funding for different programs and bills pop up, I'd like to be able to understand some of the creative options that, you know, past legislatures have had, or that local campuses and communities. I mean, you might have in St. Cloud or New Ulm or someplace a local organization that has a wonderful idea. Let's learn and cross-pollinate so we can take the best cases and give options to the different sites. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Qualm, and members, I can take a stab at giving some information about that subject matter. So one of the student testifiers from the LEAD organization mentioned the EAPS program. This is the Emergency Assistance for Postsecondary Students Grant Program. It's administered by the Office of Higher Education. It was established by the legislature in 2017. The legislature provided $175,000 in funding each year of the 2018-2019 biennium to support the EAPS program. This is a grant that OHE administers. It's available to Minnesota post-secondary institutions with a demonstrable homeless student population. In fiscal year 2019, the grant recipients included Minnesota State Community and Technical College. They have an emergency needs fund that was funded with the grant. South Central College, St. Paul College, Riverland Community College, and the Red Lake Nation College. So the EAPS program is one of the programs that deals with emergency assistance for homelessness and food insecurity faced by post-secondary students, and that was one of the programs that was mentioned by one of the testifiers from the LEAD organization.
Representative Nornes.
Yep. Madam Chair, I just was thinking of a college that I visited several years ago. I can't remember which one now because I've visited too many, but this college had a unique program which really helped students. It was like Meals by Wheels. So they would take the unused lunch or the meals that were being prepared at that campus, prepare an individual lunch. The student would take that lunch to someone in the community, and they would have lunch together. So it was an outreach program using money or food that would be tossed otherwise. And so it did two things. It also fed the student. It fed a resident in the community. And prevented a waste of food. So sometimes you can just have a creative solution. Doesn't fit everybody. Doesn't feed everybody. But I thought it was a very creative way to do some good things. Mm-hmm. Again, I just can't remember which college I was at. So
right.
Just throw that out for a thought.
Right. Any other comments by members? I know one of our testifiers had brought up the, it's called CUNY, New York, and it's a research-based program that helps provide the support services to get students through school, and in the end, it actually costs less to graduate a student than it does by not having that program, so that would probably be something for our committee to look and see if something might work for us. Okay. And we've already doing a little bit of research on that as well. Okay, well, we have a few minutes here, and we have not wrapped up our homework assignment for our staff members on how higher education has affected themselves or their families' lives. And so who would like to start that hasn't? And was there any members who didn't get to do their homework yet? I think everybody was here that day, yeah. Okay. So who would like to start? Okay, we've got our wonderful staff. Well, I'm not going to say a preface because then I have to say that about everybody, but Mr. Herring.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm trying to remember back to what my homework was. But I think I remember the question. I think the two things that really stood out to me, you know, I went to the University of Minnesota, and I had a wonderful experience there. I think the things that really stood out to me that I think about when higher education and how it impacted me and my family, for my family, like, I'm glad we're doing this a few weeks later because I think, like everyone else, I'm going to talk about my parents. I know my mom went back to school. She had me later in life. She went back to school when I was in elementary school with the Master Gardener program at the University of Minnesota. And that was something that was just really incredible for my family. You know, she started her own business. She still is running her own business. Gardening, I worked for it. My father actually, when he retired, he works with them too. And so thinking about the opportunity she had to go back later in life, start her own business, completely change careers, and how it's affected our family is really, really important. The other piece I think about, I came back to the University of Minnesota after I was diagnosed with alopecia. So when I was about a month into my first year of college, all my hair, eyebrows, everything fell out, which for a student away from home is a very terrifying experience. And one of the amazing things that I think we really take for granted living in Minnesota, I can tell you, like, I went to college in Florida at first. I've lived in Iowa, Nebraska, a few other places. No knock to all those places. But Minnesota has a really amazing medical program here, and that's because of the university system. So when I came back here, I actually was able to work with the world's leading expert on my disease, and that was something that I don't think we get in other places, and that's something that's really special here. So,
well, thank you for sharing that story. Would you? And then I'm going to. Between the two of us, we're going to do timing for 2 minutes, and hopefully everybody can share it within that amount of time. Addie,
ready?
Yes.
Okay.
Ms. Miller, would you like to go?
Madam Chair and members, thank you. Again, my name's Addie. My dad grew up in kind of a really not very nice part of southern Indiana, and the way he kind of got himself out of that was through education, getting 2 degrees from the University of or Indiana University. So we, like Representative Cleavorn, taught her kids, we were taught that that was your option. You go to college. So I did and went to a tiny school in Missouri called William Woods University, majored in equestrian science, and then went to law school after that and got my law degree from William Mitchell. So got one Minnesota school in there. And then I went to train horses after that, and I ran a business. And without that education foundation through law school, I would probably not have been as successful as I was in the horse training world. And then transitioning over into the political and government world, certainly that education helped as well. And then I also would not have some of my horses alive at this moment if it wasn't for the vets at the University of Minnesota. So I'm really excited to see what you guys all are going to do with this committee. This is such a vital time in a person's life, that college higher education age. And like many of you have said, it really makes a huge difference in multiple people's lives. So thank you all for being a part of this. I'm excited to see what we can do.
Thank you. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, I was a first-generation college student. I came to Minnesota from out of state to attend St. Olaf College. I met my now spouse in college and some of my best friends in college. That was probably the biggest way that that affected my life. After college, I decided I wasn't done with kind of that liberal arts approach and went to graduate school at Loyola University in Chicago, so from the Lutherans to the Jesuits. I was there for 2 years in a graduate program in philosophy and decided to go to law school instead and went to Northwestern University School of Law. Now it's called Pritzker School of Law. Graduated from there and eventually found my way here. So college, post-secondary education was what brought me to the great state of Minnesota. So I owe it that.
Excellent. Thank you. Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and committee members, like Mr. Hopkins, I'm an out-of-stater, so to speak. I'm a New Englander by lineage. I grew up in the New Haven area of Connecticut, about 45 minutes from the Bronx, New York, in the Southern Connecticut panhandle. I ended up going to my undergraduate education at the University of Maine on an athletic scholarship. So this weather, although insane, is pretty normal for living on the coast way up at the Canadian border like I did for so many years. I was lucky enough to finish there in 4 years, and I was offered a postgraduate scholarship to get a graduate degree in public administration. It was my intention from there on to become a college professor in public finance. And so I decided to enroll at the Humphrey Institute for Public Affairs. And after 2 years, decided that probably getting a PhD after 2 other years of graduate school wasn't my cup of tea. And so with that, I took a college administration job for a handful of years and eventually found my way to the legislature. I met my now spouse at the Humphrey Institute, and we've been kind of proud transplant Minnesotans kind of ever since.
Thank you so much. Okay, Mr. Bennett.
I already went.
You already did last time, mm-hmm. Huh? Excellent. And so then we have Ms. Lehman.
Madam Chair and members, I was very fortunate in high school to have the option of taking post-secondary education classes. And so I did that my junior and senior year. So I went to University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I already had a full semester done of credits. So I was able to skip over a lot of the general courses that you're required to take. And I went in as a pre-pharmacy major, and I quickly realized that that was not the path I was going to take and that I wanted to go to law school. And so that helped. Having the PSEO and being able to kind of dig into my classes rather more quickly at college. I figured out I wanted to go to law school, and then I went to law school, and now I'm here.
Wow, thank you for sharing. I appreciate that. And then we have our two pages over here. And I do not have their names memorized because I Seaver and Page the Page, right? But I don't know your last name, so I apologize. Did I say that right? Is it Seaver or is it? Yes, gotcha. Okay, so Seaver, you may proceed, and you can tell us your whole name of the night.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Seaver Holzer. I'm from St. Paul. I didn't go very far for school. I went to McAllister College. And it was a great experience. I love studying. I love it so much that I have applied to several doctoral programs in political science. I'm hoping to go next year. I've been admitted to UC Irvine so far. I'm awaiting the other school's responses. So education has really meant very much to me throughout my life, and I greatly enjoy hearing your input and seeing your leadership on this issue in Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And Miss, I got a lifeline here. Engelhart?
That's correct. Paige Engelhart. Thank you, Madam Chair, everyone here. Higher education is actually the whole reason for my family. My father's from Minnesota, the Mankato area. He actually went down to Arizona chasing a girl he was interested in, and my parents met at ASU, and a few months later, they found out they were having me. They moved up here. My mother ended up stopping school to raise me and my brother, and my father got his bachelor's in automotive engineering technology, and then they encouraged me and all my siblings to go to school, thanks to their support and pushing me forward, as well as some financial assistance from my grandparents. I graduated last spring from Minnesota State Mankato, same school my dad graduated from, with a bachelor's in sociology, and my brother graduated from South Central Community College with his associates in IT. And it's just seeing the that, you know, even though I don't think they've regret the decisions they've made, they've had limited opportunities and has affected our lives growing up financially, and has just given me the ambition to pursue the career that I am pursuing and the knowledge as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate everybody. Did we get everybody? I just want to make sure. Representative Nornes, you haven't gone yet.
Well, I can wait for another week.
We would love for you to go. Please share your story
with
us.
I'll make it real.
Okay, well, we know how that goes with Representative Daniels, so let's... okay.
So
I'll never live that one down.
My generation, I think, is the first in our family to consider higher education. As I look around to cousins and so forth, it seems that this is the generation that went to college. Personally, I went to Brown Institute, and that prepared me for a career for about 32 years in that field, and very lucky, I think, to be able to do that, actually. And so now, after being married for a long time, we have three kids, and they've all gone to college, one at the University of Minnesota, Carlson School, one at St. Cloud State University, and one at a tech school. From that, we have 10 grandchildren, and I could just bore you real quick here. Give you a rundown. I got one at Boulder, Colorado, graduating from the University of Colorado in May. I've got one of the grandchildren from Loyola University in California with a master's degree. Two sisters of hers that are in various schools out in California. I've got one at Washington University in D.C., going to be a physician's assistant playing soccer. One went to Boston at at the School of Music there. Berkeley, and he is a songwriter in L.A. right now. I've got one in Moorhead who's going to be an engineer transferring to NDSU this coming fall, and one graduated from Duluth University of Minnesota Duluth. I don't think I lost anybody along the way, but so they're all out there in higher education in some form, some place. And we're pretty excited about that because I told President Kaler once that the beauty of getting an education, particularly at the University of Minnesota, if it's done right, the student will actually someday pay you and send money back. You know, it's an investment that will return, hopefully someday, in your old age. So I haven't seen it yet. I'm optimistic, though. So I first of all, really appreciate being on this committee.
Well, we love having you.
Do you?
Yes.
That's good to know. So I appreciate everybody else interested in higher education. I don't expect or claim to be an expert, mm-hmm. but we learn every day. So, and I enjoyed being the chair for a while, and I enjoy sitting over here now, too. So.
Thank you.
Just being in the room. I've told many people, being in the legislature, the main thing is to be here. That's right. And then from there, you just kind of wing it. So,
very good. Well, I don't know if we'll ever have, thank you, Representative Nornes. I don't know if we'll ever have the opportunity to reflect on the conversations that we've heard from, or the history of education that we've all experienced. But it seems like we had different pathways, but similar pathways. It seemed like face some same challenges and how it impacted our lives. And we hear from students that have been coming, and some of the challenges are the same from the past, but some of them are very, very different. And so I like how this committee seems to be very open to really helping the students in Minnesota now and in the future. So I really appreciate you all sharing those stories, and I hope we can continue getting to know each other on this community and helping students across our state. So thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.